Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to this edition of The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, which is a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you to join us at one of our worship services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Or, if you live in Raynham, Kent, we meet the first Sunday of each month at 3 o'clock at the Evangelical Free Church on Wigmore Road. Or if you live in Glasgow, we meet at St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride each Sunday morning at 10 a.m. So if you live in these areas, come pay us a visit. I know you'll receive a warm welcome. If not, go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button and find the congregation that's nearest to where you live. I'd encourage you to go along and join them for worship. Again, we thank you for your prayers, for your financial support of Lutheran Radio, for both of these things enable us to keep going and carry on our worldwide outreach with Jesus' gospel to people from around the world on the internet. Over the last 3 weeks, we have been very pleased to have been joined by Dr. Jeff Leininger. Jeff is a former assistant pastor at Resurrection Lutheran Church in Cambridge. He served the congregation there while he worked on his MPhil and his PhD at Cambridge. He now serves as campus pastor for the University of Concordia in Chicago, and he has done so for many years. His area of specialty is the English Reformation, and we've been talking about that with him over the last few weeks. We've kind of been looking at the groundwork of the English Reformation with the four L's, the Lollards, the lethargy of the church and its potential to lay some groundwork for the Reformation, then the literati, or the letters of the Renaissance Christian humanists, and now we get to the final L, Lutherans. And as we talk about the Lutherans, many folks might remember the White Horse Inn, and it only seems natural that we talk about that first, Lutherans gathering in the tavern as they are known to do. So Jeff, can you tell us a little bit more about the White Horse Inn? Did that really happen? Is it really where the blue plaque says it is near King's College in Cambridge?
It is the most stubborn myth that we have about the early Lutherans in England, and but it's a wonderful story, and there is some history behind it, but there's a lot of myth surrounded by it. I mean, the idea of, you know, gathering in secret, drinking beer, you know, in a tavern at night is a really kind of appealing idea. The historicity of it really just goes back to just a few lines from John Fox's Acts and Monuments of the English Martyrs. And I'll read it for you. So John Fox was an English reformer and a bishop, and he did this wonderful historical collection of all the things that were happening in the English Reformation, especially the persecution under Mary. John Fox is very biased because history is written by the winners, and so he has very much a disdain and distaste for the traditional Catholic past. But he is also a good historian in that he collects a lot of documents, and he is one of the main sources that we have for this period. But he does have a little paragraph about the White Horse Inn. John, would it be okay if I just read that paragraph?
I'd love to hear it, Jeff.
Okay, and this is where it all comes from. This is what John Fox says. He says, "The house that they resorted most commonly unto was the White Horse, which, for despite of them, to bring God's word into contempt, was called Germany." So basically the Catholic authorities call it Germany, or Little Germany, in disparaging of it. "This house especially was chosen because many of them of St. John's, the King's College, and the Queen's College came in on the back side. At this time, much trouble began to ensue. The adversaries of Dr. Barnes accused him in the Regent House before the Vice Chancellor, where his articles were presented." So basically, that's it. Just a couple sentences about the White Horse Inn. Now, what do you notice about that? Those few sentences, John, is that he doesn't say where it was. He doesn't tell us who was there. He doesn't really even tell us what they were drinking. So it's a pretty, you know, that's it. That's all we have about the White Horse Inn. But it's sort of grown with the telling over the years, and anybody that was at all associated with the English Reformation, people say, well, it must have been there at the White Horse Inn. So I'm sorry to kind of dispel the myth a little bit on you, John.
Well, I'm going to have to go and take that plaque down then, Jeff.
I think, you know, the plaque is the reason why we don't know where the White Horse Inn was is that that whole area of King's College, you know, along King's Parade, that actually wasn't, that was just, is after the Reformation, that was all torn down. There was part of the area of the town was there, and that was all torn down when the college was expanded much later. And so we actually, you know, wherever the White Horse Inn, we don't really know where it was, but it probably has been destroyed. I think it's reasonable enough to say that it was in that area, but we just don't know for sure. You know, who was there? You could probably say that Robert Barnes, who was a Lutheran in the confessional sense, was probably there. People maybe say Thomas Bilney, names like Hugh Latimer, John Frith, Miles Coverdale, Nicholas Ridley, Matthew Parker, William Tyndale. You know, all of that with the question mark. We could say maybe they were there because they were all in Cambridge at the time. They were at these colleges, and we know they were reading Luther's works and Erasmus's works. And so we can kind of say, well, that maybe they were together at the White Horse Inn, drinking beer, talking about Luther's theology. But there's just a lot of myth that surrounds it.
So they did have access to Luther's theology. How soon did that start arriving here in the United Kingdom after Luther posted his 95 Theses? How quickly did it get to these shores?
Luther's writings start circulating 1519, 1520, and they are first burned in Cambridge at the Market Square in 1520. Cambridge really becomes the Wittenberg of England. It's not that there weren't reforming elements at Oxford, but Cambridge really was the centerpiece for the Reformation that happened. Cambridge, just sort of geographically, at one time, before the Reformation, you could access the sea all the way from the Cam, the river, because it was even tidal. So if the tide was in, you could go all the way to the sea from Cambridge on the tributaries on the river system. By the time of the Reformation, they can get books from foreign lands within about a mile of Cambridge. And so you can see how having geographical access to the sea and therefore to places like Germany or the lowlands in the Netherlands, you can see how having access to these waterways would have been very advantageous to getting these books in and reading them in Cambridge.
As you were discussing the White Horse Inn earlier, Jeff, you mentioned a number of people that possibly could have been there. Can you tell us a little bit more about maybe some of those folks and how they really impacted the English Reformation and perhaps even in a Lutheran way?
A couple names I'll mention to begin with. One would be William Tyndale, and the other is Robert Barnes. And I'll take them both in order. William Tyndale is a very well-known name and an English translator. And he is in Cambridge, and he is one that we think, you know, maybe he would have been at the White Horse Inn reading some of Luther's materials. He's the greatest and most influential Bible translator in the English language, because Coverdale used a lot of Tyndale's translations where possible, and a lot of this made its way into the King James Version of the Bible, which is a very influential English translation. So William Tyndale has an influence not just on religion, but on just the way people speak and read in English. He was in Oxford, the other place, from 1512 to 1515, but then he was also in Cambridge and exposed then to the humanist learning and the writings of Luther, and we think perhaps at the White Horse Inn was reading this illegal material. His attempts to have a vernacular translation, so an English, a fresh English translation, was rejected by the bishops, And so William Tyndale's one sort of desire, his great passion was to have the Bible translated into English and printed for everyone. Now, there had been previous English translations. We talked about the Lollard texts, and there were also even earlier, the Lindisfarne Gospels was a very early example of English translation. So it's not that it's not as if there were no English translations of the Bible that had existed. But what Tyndale wanted, he wanted a fresh, new one based not on the Latin Vulgate, but back to our humanist scholars, but back to the original Greek and Hebrew. And he wanted a translation that was fresh and vivid and vibrant, and that conveyed his convictions about his Protestant faith, rather like Luther in Germany. Luther was not the first one to translate the Bible into German, but he used the original sources, and he used the type of German that was accessible and the type of German that was spoken in the fields and in the pubs, and one that reflected his convictions about the gospel. And so that's the same thing with William Tyndale. He wants, above anything else, to have a Bible translated into the English language. And he does study, we believe, in Wittenberg. He studies with Martin Luther. And in Worms, he prints the first English New Testament in 1526. There, he tries in 1525, and I mean, it's an incredible story that the imperial authorities, so the Holy Roman Empire is very much connected with the traditional Catholic faith, and they come in on the one side of the house to arrest him, and they escape on the other side of the house in 1525 with some of the New Testament, but the full New Testament is printed then in 1526.
So, Jeff, you talked about that he was in Wittenberg. What kind of influence did Luther have on him, do you think? And can we actually call Tyndale a Lutheran?
Well, it's kind of a yes and no question. He was very influenced by Luther, and in fact, he borrows a lot from Martin Luther in terms of his translating work and his prefaces to the New Testament. In fact, he borrows so much that when they come to accuse him of heresy and begin his trial, William Tyndale's trial, they basically say, well, you're just rehashing Luther all over again, basically plagiarizing Luther. So he learns a lot from Luther. He bases his prefaces to, when he prints his New Testament in 1526, he bases his prefaces on Luther, sometimes just translating Luther word for word. His prologue to the Epistle of Romans, for example, he relies a lot on Luther's own introduction to Romans. Luther wrote famously The Freedom of the Christian, and Tyndale wrote The Obedience of the Christian, and he's borrowing some things from Luther on that. So there's a lot that he's really relying upon Luther, and sometimes even just word for word, just borrowing from Luther. So in that sense, he's very much Lutheran. What does end up happening is that he does depart from Luther's theology in a couple ways. One is on the sacrament. So Tyndale has a more spiritual view of the sacrament. Tyndale does eventually depart and does not hold to the real presence on the sacrament. That's very much controversial in the English Reformation, because you have somebody like Robert Barnes, who we'll turn to in a moment. Robert Barnes holding to a very strong Lutheran view of the Lord's Supper, and the other ones not so much. And they even want to just say, hey, let's not debate this right now. We're too fragile in this situation. Let's just hold off on this. But eventually Tyndale will then depart from Luther on the sacrament. The other significant way that he departs from Luther is that William Tyndale is much more concerned about morality and obedience. And so his ideas of justification, though he does accept justification by faith, Tyndale is very quick always to talk about the role of works in the Christian life. So one might say he accepts Paul and Romans, but he really likes to talk about James too. And so that might be another way that we say that he departs from Luther, is tends to be more moralistic, tends to be more concerned about the leading of a godly life and the moral life, and that though he doesn't depart from justification by faith, some might say he sort of compromises it because he talks too much about works, quite frankly.
Jeff, you talk about Tyndale, and that's really important for us in the LCE because our mother congregation is Luther Tyndale Memorial Church in Kentishtown. And you also then talk about Robert Barnes, and our pastors' conferences are known as the Barnes Conference. So both of these two play a significant role even in our lives in the LCE today. So can we move on and talk about Robert Barnes? Can you tell us, a man, he had quite a history and quite some adventures. Can you tell us about some of those, please?
Yes, and again, we're talking about, these are both Cambridge scholars who are reading Luther, maybe at the White Horse Inn under, with a pint, and they're bringing Luther's ideas and Luther's translations into England. William Tyndale, mainly in terms of his translation work. Robert Barnes is part of the Augustinian friars, are known as the Austin Friars in Cambridge. And John, who else was an Augustinian friar?
Mr. Martin Luther.
That's right, Mr. Martin Luther. And so Barnes is in Cambridge, part of this Augustinian order. He has connections and knows of Luther through that order. And in 1521, he introduces some of the humanist methods of scholarship to the Augustinians in Cambridge. He studies Luther's writings, we think, at the White Horse Inn. He is actually one person that John Fox actually mentions as being there. So we think Barnes is definitely there. And he begins to sort of criticize some of the traditional churchmen in the Catholic institutions in Cambridge, especially a Christmas Eve sermon in 1525. He kind of lays into them and causes quite a ruckus about this. He is later released and censured, but then he's imprisoned again, and he is eventually threatened by death and excommunication for promoting the New Testament. He does escape over to Wittenberg and studies with Luther and Melanchthon over in Wittenberg. What's interesting about Barnes is his early career, then in the 1520s, and this is still when Henry VIII, his first wife and first marriage is going great, and he's still, you know, defender of the faith and not departing from the Catholic faith at all. That's in the 1520s, and so Barnes is in bit of hot water. But later what happens is, as Thomas Cromwell begins to explore the Lutherans, and especially the Schmalkaldic League, as a political military alliance and perhaps even a theological alliance, who do they turn to but this Robert Barnes? Why? Because, well, he knows German, he's very familiar with the Lutherans, but he's English, and so he becomes sort of involved in as an emissary between Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, and the Schmalkaldic Leagues over in Germany. A Lutheran pastor named Corey Moss has written a whole book about Robert Barnes. You can Google that. He's done an in-depth study about him. What's really fascinating to me about Robert Barnes is that, you know, he ends up in the end being Lutheran in a confessional sense. He does, before he leaves England, he does sign on to the Augsburg Confession. He begins to preach justification, which makes him a heretic. And he is burned at the stake in 1540 after the fall of Thomas Cromwell for his views. And so it is very interesting to me that here you have an Englishman, Augustinian monk, who understands the gospel, stays true to the theology of the real presence, and also, you know, is very strongly preaches justification. So a true English Lutheran in every sense of the word.
Jeff, you talk about that Christmas Eve sermon that got him into such hot water. What was it that upset the authorities when they heard about it?
It's an interesting story, and it's actually you can actually go to the church. The church is still there, St. Edward the Confessor. In fact, my recent sabbatical over in the UK, we were able to go there and even talk to one of the church wardens there. So the church is there. The pulpit is there. So if you are in Cambridge, you can go to St. Edward the Confessor right by the Market Square, and the pulpit that Barnes preached the first Lutheran sermon from is actually there. You can stand in and get a nice photo there. What's happening with this St. Edward the Confessor is that it's what's called a royal peculiar, in that its jurisdiction, because of some of its history, does not go directly to the bishop. The jurisdiction, the ecclesiastical supervision, goes directly to the crown, namely Thomas Cromwell at this point. And so it's got a little bit of freedom. And so he is invited by Latimer to preach in this church. Barnes is an Augustinian, so he's not the parish preacher, but he's invited by Latimer to preach in this church. And he's got a little bit of freedom because it's not directly under the supervision of the bishop. And so he's got a bit of freedom. He preaches that sermon. And what really gets him into hot water is he preaches against Christians having lawsuits against one another, namely one of the church wardens who was, you know, executing this lawsuit, really, and the kind of the victims of this lawsuit were some of the poor people in the parish. And so Barnes kind of lays into this guy a bit, and so he kind of raises a ruckus about it. He talks a lot in this sermon about the reforming of ecclesiastical abuses. We don't know in this sermon that he actually preached justification per se, because we don't have the content of the sermon, but we know that he did preach against ecclesiastical abuses, and there were people that showed up at that sermon expecting it to be quite controversial, and it was. And so we don't know the full content of the sermon, but it certainly got him into trouble, and he raised a lot of eyebrows and pushed a lot of buttons in that very pulpit at St. Edward the Confessor.
So, Jeff, you talked about Tyndale and Barnes, but you also mentioned Thomas Cranmer, and he played a huge role as the Archbishop of Canterbury under Henry VIII, and a lot of people think he's Lutheran. Can you tell us a little bit about him and how he fits in with this picture, and was he Lutheran?
In the end, he did not end up being doctrinally Lutheran, but in the early days in Cambridge in the 1520s, like other people, he is reading Luther's writings. I mean, he is at Jesus College. Cambridge has a doctorate in 1526. We don't know if he was really involved with the White Horse Inn discussions, but he is an early proponent of this Renaissance Christian humanism in England. And eventually he does become converted to the Protestant faith, and the reading of Luther was very influential on him. And Luther has this long ongoing effect on him, and then therefore in the English Reformation, especially through Cranmer's liturgical changes. So when he writes the Book of Common Prayer, and he writes the Articles of Religion for the English Church, he is very strongly influenced by Martin Luther. And so what you have with Thomas Cranmer, although in the end he becomes more reformed following the way of Calvin, in terms of his Eucharistic theology and some other parts of his theology, early on he's very strongly influenced from Luther, especially with his liturgical reforms. When you think a little bit, John, about like how these historical things worked out, one of the kind of ironies that I like to point out is that when the Lutherans in the United States decided that instead of using German, they're going to use English. And that happens in 1941, World War II. There's a good reason for that. They start to go to, they want to use English in their hymnals. Where do they turn to? But to Thomas Cranmer. They turn to Thomas Cranmer because his liturgical reforms were, of course, in English. But where did Thomas Cranmer get those liturgical reforms? He got them from Martin Luther, or many of them. And so kind of the irony is that the Lutherans using English went through Cranmer to get back to Luther. And I think that is just a wonderful little irony. For example, one, you know, the phrase, in the midst of life, we are in death. You know, that is a Luther, but Cranmer translated it and put it in the Book of Common Prayer, and then we get it back in the Lutheran liturgies in both America and in the United Kingdom.
As we're, again, coming to the close of our time, Jeff, you mentioned all these people who were influenced deeply by Luther and who had profound importance in Henry's governments. And also, I mean, people say many of the queens that Henry was married to were influenced by Lutherans and maybe even Lutherans. So why is it that, do you think, that England didn't become a Lutheran country, that it sort of bypassed and went on to Geneva in the end?
I think a couple of factors come to mind. One factor is that Henry's and Luther's personal animosity, they never quite got over that. They really tried, but Luther did not, you know, sanction Henry's divorce. Henry writing this assertion of the seven sacraments against Luther, you know, that sort of personal quarrel, they never could get over that. They're very enamored with Melanchthon. In fact, they begged Melanchthon. They wanted Melanchthon to come over to England, but Luther himself was just the personality conflict, I think, was pretty strong for them to get over. The other thing that happens is that Thomas Cranmer, under Edward VI follows Henry VIII, and he's very much a strongly reforming monarch. But they very much have connections with Martin Bucer, Peter Martyr Vermiglia, and the Calvinist Reformation. They have very strong influences from the Calvinist Reformation under Edward VI. And so they become, in some ways, from the Lutheran perspective, suspect because of their low view of the sacrament, more spiritual views of the sacrament. So there's, you know, from very early on, there's a strong Calvinist influence under Edward VI's reign with Cranmer himself, and that makes him quite suspect to Lutherans, because Lutherans held very much to that the idea of the real presence. And then maybe a third factor that pushed against why didn't England ever become Lutheran. You have to remember too that Lutheranism was very much associated with Germany, and it's sort of like if you're an English monarch, you know, do you really need the Germans to tell you about your theology? And so there's a sort of national pride about that too, both with Henry VIII for sure. You know, why did the Lutherans have to lecture me? Why did the Germans have to lecture me about theology? But also, I think under later monarchs like Elizabeth I, you know, they wanted it to be an English church. They wanted it to be an English Reformation, knowing that it's influenced, of course, by Martin Luther, but not wanting to just accept, you know, some confessional documents from Germany. And so I think those are three things that come to mind, and there's a number of other historical, political reasons, we might say. But it is an interesting, as a Lutheran pastor who lived in England and our audience here on Lutheran Radio, you think, wow, things could have been maybe a little different. And is it possible that England could have been a Lutheran country at one point completely? And I think it's a historical possibility, but there were a number of factors that were really pushing against it.
Dr. Jeff Leininger, we thank you for, again, sharing your insights and your wisdom with us on Lutheran influence on the English Reformation. Again, we thank you, and we deeply appreciate your wonderful insights. And may God bless you in your work as pastor of Concordia University in Chicago, Illinois. Thank you for being with us at Westfield House this summer, and God's richest blessings as you continue your ministry and work in Chicago.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.